Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
It's Friday, and boy, do we have news for you. Time to catch up on what's been happening lately across Chicago and Illinois in our weekly news recap, where we take you behind the headlines with local journalists working on stories like these.
Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson has reached the halfway point in his tenure.
Going into the second half without a permanent lead at CPS, CHA, and CTA.
This is not about an individual or an individual's name. This is about the character that this person has to reflect.
He wants John Robertson to take over at CTA in an interim position.
Fiery comments at today's CTA board meeting as Alderman David Moore warned directors not to be a, quote, backbiting snake.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Lots to dive into, and I cannot do it alone. So here to dive deep into those stories and much more, we had WBEZ Senior Editor for Government Politics and Safety, Angela Rosa O'Toole. Alex Nitkin, Government Finance and Accountability Reporter with the Illinois Answers Project at the Better Government Association. And for the first time on the weekly news recap, we had Block Club Chicago reporter Mac Lederman. It's now official. Brandon Johnson's been in office for 2 years, the halfway point of his term. Mac sat down with Johnson one-on-one and began filling us in on how that conversation went. Here's Mac.
Just for a little context here, I was thinking about how the same time last week that I went to go speak with the mayor, I was sitting across the street from a DePaul student who is throwing the biggest party of the year on his campus. So a very different interview, I'd say, than what I'm usually doing at Block Club.
Right.
So, you know, as someone who doesn't cover, you know, politics every single day, I thought I kind of really had a unique position to really come in with him with a clean slate and kind of see what he was about, what he believes his accomplishments are, and what is his pitch to the people of Chicago, making the lives of people in Chicago better. So just to zoom out a little bit on Brandon Johnson, because I think this is last year, but this is someone who's had a long and laborious career, a part of larger political movements. He's not a singular force of personality in the way other big city successful mayors are. Someone like a Lori Lightfoot or an Eric Adams. He was really swept into power as an underdog, as a part of, you know, kind of a meddling person who'd go and give the stump speeches on a picket line at labor protests. But he kind of went into this position with this posturing that, you know, he was going to be this bigger, larger than life personality, this singular mayor. And in many ways, that kind of backfired for him.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, cornered in many different directions. We've seen a real divide between his progressive coalition as well as, you know, Black communities over issues like ShotSpotter and his decision to put migrants inside Park District fieldhouses during the crisis. He's ran into a city council that has a very consolidated, strong, moderate coalition that has blocked much of his agenda.
Yeah, and he's expressed some regret for some of what you just mentioned.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and then there's a pressure from above. You know, he's been stuck with this 7% mark from the 7% approval mark from a Republican poll about him. And he's facing hits from all these different directions, and he's been boxed in. And the first thing he needs to do is he needs to, you know, kind of reestablish a clean slate in himself. So the way he's spinning it is that he's had communications issues, that he hasn't done enough to convince Chicago of the job he's doing and how he, you know, how he's defending himself. So, you know, in this era of politics where I feel like where you say no wrong and you admit no wrong, and we see that, you know, in the man in the White House right now, he's trying to take a different approach.
Interesting. Did he say what he's most proud of?
If you ask him, it's a bunch of things. It's the way he balanced two budgets, his plan for affordable housing involving a $1.25 billion change to how we do TIFs, which is a way we fund things here in the city. So he's claiming accomplishments, but, you know, someone like me who's used to interviewing the DePaul student across the table at the coffee center on the campus, you know, sitting down there and through and sorting through spin was rather a challenge.
Yeah, very, very different, that political interview, isn't it, Angela? WBEZ.
Absolutely can be, yes.
WBEZ political editor, senior editor. Now, our city politics reporter, Mariah Wolfel, also did a lengthy interview with the mayor last week. What stood out to you, Angela?
Yeah, she and Fran Spielman from the Sun-Times sat down with him. And I mean, the walk away from that was sort of the beginning of the mea culpa tour that you're referring to, recognizing that his, you know, his chances of running again are hampered by the low approval rating, but a lot of missteps. I think the thing that stuck out for me listening to the mayor talk time and time again was, I do think, a sober assessment of his failures. And that does stand out from always his sort of pushback that it's the pushback from the others and others who are holding him back. But I did have to have a laugh because in that pushback and that mea culpa, it was still about communication. Mm. Him saying, no, I've done the right things. It's that I've not told people how right I am and they are not getting it.
So
and
that's what he means by communication issues.
Real, yeah. I'm sorry you feel that way kind of energy.
It was.
Like, you just can't see all the good things that I'm doing and that's what I'm doing wrong.
But talking to Mariah about this, she, you know, she had a list of this went wrong and this went wrong. And he just kept saying, yep, yep, yep. And so she, you know, she's telling me she felt like she had to skip ahead because they thought they were going to have to sort of pigeonhole him on these. He admitted to them, but always had sort of a response in terms of, yes, these things did not go well. Let's just take the CTU, right? I'm sorry, CPS and Pedro Martinez. And his pushback there, you know, a lot of people say, maybe you should have gotten rid of him sooner. And they asked that question. And he was just like, yeah, maybe. But, you know, maybe that was my failure, was not pushing him out sooner because I realized later that he really didn't have my back. And Mariah and I talked a lot about that. And it was like, or you were wrong about trying to push forward a very risky bond issue to pay for to pay for ongoing expenses like salaries. So it's just, you know, it was an interesting interview. I do think it was an interesting moment, the mea culpa tour, and we'll see how well that's going to do for him in the future.
What are you thinking, Alex, when you think on 2 years with Brandon Johnson?
Look, there are so many different things that you can point to. It's been a very tumultuous 2 years, and he has had, excuse me, his share of wins and has had a lot of bumps in the road, to put it generously. But when I think of it, I think it really in so many ways comes back to the fact that as a candidate, his big pitch was there is a fundamental structural imbalance in the city's budget. We're not bringing in enough money. And I'm going to raise $800 million a year in extra money in order to fund this really reimagining and expansion of government and to reverse so many of these sort of cutting, streamlining, privatizing austerity measures that Rahm Emanuel did and Lori Lightfoot did to a lesser extent. He was going to reopen the mental health clinics and open, you know, rerun all, sort of expand all of these public services. The fundamental problem is that he has since then accomplished almost nothing to actually raise that new revenue. And so the city finds itself in this really increasingly difficult, precarious financial situation where we're going to face a probably $1 billion plus budget deficit. And he is in the position of, who am I going to try to make the least mad? What position? What is the least worst position that I can be in?
Which is a very tough position to be in.
Oh yeah, politically and as someone who's leading, you know, a $16 billion organization.
Right.
And so it's not where he wants to be. And he has some of these, you know, bonds and things that he can look at. I thought that one thing that was really interesting in terms, you know, when he says, you know, I was a little bit too, I didn't act fast enough on things like Pedro Martinez. I wonder if some folks think he might be sort of taking the wrong lesson from that when they look at him and see someone who has not collaborated enough, who has not invited enough feedback or, you know, done enough lobbying or built enough relationships. And it seems like he's saying, like, no, I should have, like, worked harder to put up more guardrails, to drown out all of the other voices that I don't agree with, to just sort of like hunker down and do what I want to do faster. And I'm not really sure that that would have necessarily been better.
Now, sticking with City Hall, we actually have breaking news. Just about 8 minutes ago, we received an email from City Hall that the Bears are shifting their stadium focus fully back to Arlington Heights. Angela? Anyway, you're making a face.
Because is it breaking news?
I think things have been moving
Arlington
in
Heights.
That direction for a little while. Yeah,
Arlington
this was
Heights.
My hunch as well.
This was your hunch?
I don't know. It's are a ping pong game.
Are we
it,
happy
folks?
With this?
If it means less traffic on Lakeshore, Jusaba Lakeshore Drive, selfishly, sure, maybe. I mean, I think that this is something that, especially in the last, I don't know, year or so, based on the behavior of the McCaskies and the Bears ownership group, it seemed like they have been turning their attention back to Arlington Heights. And if anything, has made the mayor look a little bit more foolish in his continuing attempt to, like, try to lure the Bears here and make them look like a real legislative and economic priority. But I don't know. I'm not a football fan.
It should be mentioned that there is a strong coalition of NFL teams that have stadiums in the suburbs already. Just
That's
because
right.
of the sheer amount of space you're able to provide.
New York's the first one that comes to mind for me.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at just these sprawling visuals of these renderings of what that stadium in Arlington Heights looked like, it'd be a full-on college campus, if not bigger, and a little bit more shinier, Sasha.
Yeah.
So the amount of events that they could host there, especially if they can connect transit to it,
right.
to the city, that seems like a best-case scenario for the Bears.
Yeah, but would this be a big blow to Mayor Johnson's legacy that we just talked about if the Bears leave Chicago?
Well, he's already being questioned on his progressive bona fides for announcing himself as a fan of the new Bears Stadium on the lakefront and admitting that it would require public funding to get it done. Another example of how he's kind of, losing his progressive base in a way. That was, I think, one of the largest sore spots that had with him is this
right.
White elephants, these stadiums that are not good return on investments for the public, but continue to be financed as these billionaire owners of these teams play this really back and forth, this ping-ponging, as Angela said, with the idea of leaving and skipping town.
Well, while we're on the topic of Mayor Johnson, let's jump to this here. He's getting pushback over his pick over the head of CTA. What is the latest with that, Mac?
So all reports indicate that Brandon Johnson is preparing to appoint his chief operating officer, John Roberson, who is a longtime City Hall exec dating back to the Dailies. He had an acrimonious exit with Daily Number 2 when his name came off on a list of whistleblowers in a federal corruption campaign. But since he's found his way back to City Hall, he was the aviation commissioner
mm-hmm.
for 19 months in the early 2000s. But he has no experience operating a major public transit system. And we're coming off this time where there was fierce opposition to the way the CTA was being run. Block Club reported a series of stories about how former CTA president Dorval Carter had not even been using the transit system that he was assigned with running,
right.
as he had focused more on big modernization products like the Red Line extension. Riders on the system were asking, hey, what about us? I'm having trouble getting to work every day. I got to swipe in my card and I stand on the platform mm-hmm. and the train doesn't come, so I got to call an Uber.
Yes.
I think that's less of a problem now. I mean, just in my anecdotal experience, I've seen improvements on the CTA. Their staffing is up a bit, but just that kind of acrimonious taste in the mouth of riders and transit advocates is leading to them all now asking for, like, hey, let's get a seasoned transit executive into this position. Carter, for what it's worth, was that. He did have a background in transit, but the CTA president is usually a job filled by career bureaucrats, people kind of who have this profile of someone like a John Roberson. I asked the mayor himself during our interview if he was committing to a national search, and his answer was, it's already done.
Mm. I looked everywhere, and I've come up with my answer.
National search. Turning to another transit topic, 11 new speed cameras went up this week. This is the second round of 50 cameras that the mayor says will bring in nearly $11.5 million in 2025. Great news, right, folks? Yeah. The cameras, they're spread throughout the city, but if you want the exact location, our colleague Fran Spielman lists all the addresses for you in her article for the Sun-Times. What were you about to say, Alex?
Just, I think that one thing that comes out of this for me is that it really undermines what the city's and the mayor's administration, the Chicago Department of Transportation's explanation for these cameras. They're all about safety. They're not here to be a cash grab. They're not here to get your money. They're really just here to influence behavior. And we know that they work for that, that they slow people down.
Yeah.
They make the roads safer. The reason why we have these particular 11 now is because they needed to close $11 million in the budget. And they were like, mm-hmm. oh, we'll just add speed cameras. And it's like, well, how can you say that it's not about money? So,
well, more bad news where that came from about the city's hated parking meter deal. What is the latest damage to taxpayers Angela?
It is the gift that keeps not giving, for sure. So this, you know, the parking meter deal the city under previous administrations was from, selling off parking meters. Over the years, the city has danced with how much money it owes to Chicago Parking Meters, Incorporated or LLC with the... and during the pandemic, Mayor Lightfoot made this sort of risky move of eliminating a few thousand spaces under a sort of loophole that they could take them offline and then give them back to CPM after a few months with a sort of different structure of how the money for those parking meters would go. And the reason that she said at the time was they wanted to clear some spaces around hospitals and other areas to make sure there was a free flow, no parking, right? Mm-hmm. But what this went under, of course, they got sued over this. And under arbitration, the argument from the other side was, no, you did this knowing that the money, you could sort of recoup some of the money, not have to pay us some of the money during this parking meter hiatus, if you will. And it's all false. So they sued, and now we're at the point where the success here is that Brandon Johnson's administration was able to knock down this ask of about, what, $150 million or something they were asking for, and now it's going to be $15 million. So it's some portion of the amount an arbitrator said this is how much. So now the city has to push this through. So it's a smaller amount, but it is just – it's still the gift that just keeps –
Well, the good news, it's only in effect until 2083. So
thank you for that, Alex. I was looking for some good news.
I think long story short here is that everyone should walk as many places as you can. Especially on a day like today, it's absolutely beautiful.
It is gorgeous today. Sticking with that topic of the city's revenue and finances, the mayor's office is blocking the press from attending its annual investor conference. First of all, what is that event, Alex?
Yeah, this was really interesting and honestly quite surprising. This is just an event that has some historical precedent. Every single year, the mayor of Chicago invites business leaders from around the country, from around the world, as a sort of like economic expo, as a big event to roll out this presentation of like, don't believe the naysayers. Look at this incredibly economically diverse and vibrant city that gets all of this tourism. We're one of a kind. To really just show off the city to investors. And naturally, this was all always open to the public. And it was something that it was designed that way because that's the whole point. It's an expo. You're trying to show off the virtues of the city and why everyone should invest in it. And so it really turned a lot of heads this year when the Johnson administration announced that it was going to be closed to the press and, and by extension closed to the public. The explanation that they gave was, well, we wanted to make some of these business leaders feel a little more comfortable that they could be more candid in the questions
but
that they're
asking. It's so important for reporters to be able to attend and get this kind of information firsthand, no?
Yeah, I agree. And honestly, it's... to all of our bosses' credit, there was a letter that was co-signed by multiple different media organizations, including Block Club, including WBZ, including BGA, saying, you know, this is outrageous, this is wild, it's inexplicable, and also pretty self-effacing. I mean, and frankly, just embarrassing to them that, you know, it's basically just them showing that they are not confident enough in their own message. Mm-hmm. And so it just really seems like one of these kinds of self-inflicted PR wounds that could have been avoided.
Yeah. Communication gaffes, would you say?
You know, the problem, he's just not getting his message out. I wonder what he could do about that.
Communicate.
Yeah.
Well, before we take a quick pause, I want to stick on this topic of getting access to the information that we need to get our jobs done as journalists, Mac. Block Club is suing the federal government. This is over violating the Freedom of Information Act. What is going on?
So if you recall back to the first week of Trump, which feels decades ago at this point, am I right on that?
Yeah.
He made a big show about, you know, and Tom Holm and his border czar had come and visited the Chicago. He said his mission started in Chicago. And at least on a PR front, he followed up on that. He came out to Chicago with ICE and federal agencies across the board. And he brought Dr. Phil with him to record it and tried to make a big show about this rounding up of Chicago's most violent illegal criminals, as they call it. But they would not say what these people were being arrested for, where they were being sent, and who they were. So all of that we could do as a local press is really try to piece it together. I know the Tribune did some fantastic reporting about how some of these arrests were so-called collateral arrests. So people storming into the homes, usually in the suburbs, where I imagine police are a little bit more cooperative.
And we also
than
don't
Chicago.
Know how many they rounded up, right?
So Superintendent Snelling said that they had arrested around 100 people. It's still really unclear whether this was even an extended mission or a roundup, say, than like normal ICE activity.
Yeah.
Just in Chicago. And our colleague McDunkey has been asking this about this for months. And the response has been boilerplate. So we're now working with a FOIA lawyer team to see if we can get actual documents about ICE about their arrests they're
making. Interesting. We'll have to keep an eye and see how this goes for you all. The retirement announcement of two 80-year-old politicians, Senator Dick Durbin and Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, not running for re-election, it's really shaking up the political landscape. And on top of that, there's that growing speculation about Governor Pritzker's presidential aspirations. We started with the Senate race, which is having a domino effect of opening up other congressional seats. Angela began by telling us who's in the race so far.
Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton has thrown her hat in first. Representatives Robin Kelly and Raja Krishnamoorthy, they're all on board. The seat, you know, Durbin's seat is vastly important. This turnover is huge for Illinois, with both Jan Schakowsky and Durbin deciding not to run again. It's such a moment for this political landscape, and you can see everybody lining up and then them lining up, with Kelly and Krishnamoorthy deciding to run. That means that their congressional seats then become open, and then you have people lining up for those seats. So it's really, Domino's is right. It's really lining up across the state to have some huge political implications.
So we've got at least two House members giving up their seats to run for Senate. Any candidates for either of those congressional spots?
We have State Senator Robert Peters, who wants to go for Representative Kelly's seat. I'm not sure about others at this time. You know, it's still, again, it's still, like, they're going to come one right after another. There's lots of speculation about, like, the early horse tries to, oh gosh, I hate using the word horse, but the early candidate is trying to clear the field.
Mm-hmm.
But you never know, like, successful candidates can come much later. So for all of these races, this is just like, I need a spreadsheet. I need some charts. lots of photographs.
Right.
Because we're in it. It's going to be quite the year.
Alex, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, she's got the endorsements of Pritzker and Senator Duckworth. We've got Congressman Krishnamoorthy, who has a $20 million campaign war chest. And then Congresswoman Robin Kelly comes with more than a decade of experience on Capitol Hill. Do you feel like there's a clear front runner in the race?
It's hard to say. I think that the only confident expectation that I'll make is that we'll get to see lots of ads for all three of them.
Absolutely.
So gird yourself for that. I mean, I did think it was interesting that so many, you know, you could see a version of this scenario where the governor and Senator Durbin say, I'm going to stay neutral. I'm going to stay out of it. I need to let this process play out. And so I think that a lot of these big players, including the governor himself, in the very beginning, trying to put a stake in the ground and saying, like, no, we're consolidating support around Lieutenant Governor Stratton. In many ways, I think positions her as sort of, in my mind, the one to beat at this point.
Yeah.
But we also know that, you know, the governor's endorsement is not ironclad,
it's not
infallible, especially in a Democratic primary, which can be pretty unpredictable.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's also got I think you're absolutely right. To plus one on that, he's also got money.
Oh, yeah.
So when you look
and
money means airtime, and airtime means name recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that despite being lieutenant governor, Juliana Stratton doesn't necessarily have that household name.
Yeah.
And Pritzker and his massive, you know, billions can change that if he chooses to do so. So it could.
He might.
Right.
He
so
might.
It'll be really interesting to see what happens.
So far, we've got two U.S. representatives officially in the Senate race, but we have a couple other representatives seriously considering it, right, Angela?
Yes. I think, you know, Representative Lauren Underwood, Republican Darren LaHood, Central Illinois, Underwood there's some musing that she may try to throw her name in, but that, you know, when you start to get a crowded field across here, you know, you really have to look seriously at your ability and what you could could risk by throwing, if you've already got a seat and you're going to throw your name in and you're going to give up your other seat. So it's just, it's a question mark, I think, across the board here as to how crowded this field will get.
Yeah. We've also got Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky's seat opening up. Who is officially entering that race?
So we have the first, I think, before Ms. Schakowsky even stepped down was the digital creator Kat Abu-Ghazaleh. Thank you. I knew I was going to mess that one up. Just this week, I think maybe even yesterday, very popular and progressive Mayor Evanston Daniel Biss has thrown his name in, State Senator Lauren Fine, Justin Ford of Chicago. The list goes on. It's really, again, an interesting time because you have a really stalwart progressive, as Jan Schakowsky is known as, not someone, she was already very much in that camp. So to see other progressives stepping in like Daniel Biss and wanting to take on this seat, it's an interesting race.
So I want to turn now to the politics percolating around J.B. Pritzker. He remains noncommittal about whether he'll seek a third term as governor. What are you hearing, Angela? And Mac, you're giving me a look. I feel like you're hearing some stuff, too. So I'll go to you first, Angela.
Sure. Dave McKinney had a really fun story this past week. He was hearing word that he's leaning toward running for the next term. He's not going to make that announcement until, one, the legislative session would end, not wanting to get in the way of that and get his agenda going through. And two, you know, there's some nominating petitions that are due that start getting circulated in August. So that gives us kind of a runway.
Yeah.
But the interesting part, I think, here was you have folks like David Axelrod out there talking about whether or not he should run again if he's thinking about 2028, right? Thinking about the presidency. And
Axelrod's advice was basically, don't do that.
It was. He wasn't the only one. There's a couple of different consultants that McKinney talked to. The reason being, and I thought, because first when I heard Dave telling me this, I'm like, why? And then he said, because what happens in your third term that you just become a punching bag during the beginning of your third term where you need to be going all in on a presidential run. You need to be crisscrossing the country. Mm-hmm. What happens when everything you do gets picked on by the Trump administration, gets picked on by every other candidate?
Yeah.
You really just put yourself much more in the potential limelight for failure.
It does sound like it makes things more difficult for you. What are you hearing about Pritzker and the willy won't he conversation, Mac?
Yeah, I mean, I just find it very interesting, this push-pull that Pritzker has between his national ambitions and whether he needs to shore up support back home, which I think the Stratton race illustrates really well. Just an example, I mean, I think it's a good problem to have, right, if you're a politician. But his iron grip, I think, on the city, at least in his support, was really illustrated. I went to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra recently, and it was based off a story I wrote about this organization called Equity Arc, which takes musicians of color and gives them opportunities, pays for them for instruments to go and perform on big stages, like at the orchestra.
Okay.
They were supposed to play with the Trump military band, but Trump, given his attack on diversity, equity, inclusion program, canceled the concert.
Okay.
So they raised hundreds of thousands of dollars, I believe, in donations after that had happened. And they were set to perform at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And guess who showed up was none other than Governor J.B. Pritzker.
Really?
Who's really put himself on this bully pulpit against Donald Trump. I think that was a statement of himself, of him being there. And he received a standing ovation from the crowd at the Symphony Orchestra, which was almost longer than maybe some of the concert masters I've seen there. So just a sense of his support. I've never seen that type of reaction to a politician anywhere. I've seen, you know, excitement for people being around the mayor when he's out in public. But as far as that sheer amount of support for Pritzker in that setting, I mean, I just, and for someone who, you know, comes from a billionaire background, it was kind of
unremarkable. And then in the context of, you know, just this anti-Trump sort of rhetoric, it's telling. He's posturing himself to run for president. I feel so. There's another name that keeps popping up, which is Rahm Emanuel, former Chicago mayor and congressman. Where might he fit into this political game of musical chairs, Alex?
I think he wants us to think anywhere. He is certainly out in the media and getting a lot of attention, and stoking a lot of speculation that he might either run for president or run for governor.
Did you see him on The View? On ABC's.
You know
The
what?
View?
I missed that episode of The View.
He said, I'm in training. to run, but he also said, I might not make the Olympics, which set off this little tete-a-tete between Pritzker and
him.
He
loves to tease us.
Yeah, there's a bit of a back and forth.
The ladies on the panel invited him to come back there when he's ready to make his announcement, because they're just convinced that he's jumping in.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm skeptical still a little bit. I think that he left public service as mayor and consciously didn't run for a third term because he had a clear-eyed view of the very real baggage, political baggage that was lined up against him. There was that one time he presided over a conspiracy to cover up the murder of a child so he could win re-election. And now looking at the sort of like what his platform is, I'm putting on my like political pundit hat. I'm not entirely sure what his voting constituency would be that he would gain support for. It seems like if he's running on sort of like selling centrism as a virtue unto itself, it kind of reminds me of like the 2020 Mike Bloomberg campaign, who did not end up getting a lot of support. And like Rahm could definitely raise a whole lot of money, but not Bloomberg money. So
Is it just centrism? Because I've heard him saying we need to be more about the bottom line than the bathroom. Or is it I am the tough guy? And I could put a couple of expletives between those words.
Yeah.
Who does not mind being just as rude as that guy, and I will get up in their face.
Oh.
Like, is that going to be the selling point for Rahm Emanuel, the guy with a missing finger that's key?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And is willing to get out there and do what it takes to beat.
Hmm.
That's what I'm what like. I'm trying to imagine.
If people you care raise more about questions. That than what he would do, then maybe
some people might. I'm like imagining his, you know, his sticker. That's like I will F things up, and just like getting people to vote for him for that. Can
it
I
worked,
say F?
It worked for the current.
Yeah, you said F. That's fine.
All right.
You didn't say the word.
I didn't.
Now, in other state politics, the Illinois House passed legislation yesterday requiring more thorough background checks before police officers are hired. This comes less than a year after a Sangamon County sheriff's deputy shot and killed Sonia Massey. And there's other news involving that tragedy. The Illinois Supreme Court is considering releasing the deputy who killed Massey while he awaits trial. So we're definitely going to keep an eye on that. Now, before we take a break, Alex, the Illinois Answers Project, you all just completed an investigation into something at our state prisons that I don't know that many of us are familiar with. Can you fill us in?
Yeah, they're called restraint chairs, and they are restraint device used in jails, pre-trial jails all over the state of Illinois, the UN Committee on Torture categorizes and regards as literal torture. It is taking a detainee and strapping down their ankles and wrists and shoulders so that often circulation is cut off and they cannot move. And I was not really part of this, but my colleagues, Grace Houck and Meredith Newman, have been doing this really incredibly diligent and painstaking work over basically the past year, uncovering abuse after abuse after abuse after abuse in county jails all over the state of Illinois, of instances where children were put into these chairs, where people were kept in them for hours and hours and hours on end, and they suffered real health damage, to say nothing of the emotional damage and trauma that they sustained. And so they have their latest piece that they put in this investigation that was published on IllinoisAnswers.org, if you want to check it out, was looking at some other states that did rely on restraint chairs for basically, you know, someone is suffering a mental health crisis. Let's just like restrain them in a way that's going to traumatize them, and looked at places in California and Pennsylvania and Iowa that really implemented reforms that found more humane ways to treat people who are going through crises or having self-harm
episodes.
So
we get some sort of hint of solutions in that piece.
Potentially, or at least ways forward or alternatives to what is a really brutal abusive practice happening every day and funded by our taxes.
The city's contributing $7 million towards raising the wages for Chicago's childcare workers. But how will this work? Angela explained.
So we know that childcare is such a stopper for families and for the workers involved, that it's really expensive for childcare, and yet childcare workers get paid much less than what I think most people think they should get paid. So the city says it's trying to sort of support that gap in giving pay raises directly to the workers rather than having agencies increase wages and then pass those on to families. So that's what the project is about. They're looking to increase wages between 5 and 10% for about 3,000 early child care workers in an effort to sort of like push through a taxpayer-funded pay raise for some of the most needed and necessary workers in the city.
We've also got two alarming stories this week about young kids being given cannabis edibles. First, nearly a dozen students ages 11 to 14 at Far Southside Fort Dearborn School, they got sick and some were hospitalized after eating cookies that a classmate passed out that contained marijuana. And over in Northwest Suburban Wheeling, a woman there handed out cannabis candies to four children between the ages of 2 and 9. This was at a local park. And police have now arrested 48-year-old Dagmara Rouse of South Suburban Robbins for that incident. Apparently, young children ingesting marijuana products is significantly on the rise, and it's not that uncommon. Some people are calling now on legislators to do something, to mandate stricter labeling on packaging laws. And we're not sure, though, if that would have helped in either of the cases I just mentioned. But it's a start. You've got more upbeat news, though, Mac.
Yeah, let's go there, Sasha.
Also involving kids and a debate program. What's up?
So my colleague Jamie Nisbet-Goldman has been writing about Chicago Debates, which is a program that's been running for 3 decades now that is funded inside CPS schools by CPS, but CPS effectively pulled the rug out from under the program this last year, and the only reason they really gave was, we don't have to give you the money. It was $1.3 million that Chicago Debates was supposed to receive. They received $200,000 of that only. This came as a surprise, according to Chicago Debates workers. It left them scrambling, but they still took kids to a national debate championship in Atlanta, and the kids from Chicago won not just the English version, but also the Spanish version of the National Debate Championship. And I want to say their names, because it's nice to hear your name on the radio.
Sure. Yes.
Kenwood Academy seniors Caitlin Shaw and Amonte Washington, and Back of the Yards College prep students Angela Terra Blanca and Wendy DePaz are the winners of the National Debate
Championship. Congratulations to you all.
Absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah.
I love that. Let's turn now to Pope Mania, the latest news on the Pope. I feel like I need to make some like special music for that, because I feel like I'm going to be doing this every week. As we've all heard, he grew up in South Suburban Dalton. Some residents, though, Alex, they're hopeful there that their hometown and the Pope's hometown, that we could get some economic development maybe and some you know, boost in property values, right?
Yeah, why not? And who can blame them? Suddenly, this, you know, kind of small,
everybody's talking about Dalton.
Everybody's talking about the South Suburbs. We got a South Suburban Pope.
People who knew nothing about the South Suburbs from across the country now know about Dalton.
Yeah,
specifically.
And listen, I mean, it's a town with a long and complicated history of a long industrial background, in the middle of a really big rail hub, has really experienced a lot of economic decline over the last couple of decades, and has gotten itself into a lot of, I'll say, tricky political and government turmoil. I'd encourage folks to read my colleague Casey Toner at Illinois Answers has written a lot about sort of the government of Dalton and episodes of sort of corruption and foul play that have happened there. And also property tax rates have gotten very, very high
Super high.
Of depopulation in Dalton and the surrounding suburbs there. But this is part of, you know, there has been some economic development in the area. There's been more renewed attention. And so, yeah, I think folks are hopeful that this will create an opportunity for a kind of tourism along the lines of, say, like a Graceland, Elvis's boyhood home in Tennessee, or a you know, like the Jackson family's home in Gary. And so, you know, Judith Crown and Cranes had a good exploration of some of the possibilities there and why folks are excited about it. We'll just have to see how they take it, because it can go in any number of directions.
Well,
his
childhood home was listed for $219,000 up until last Thursday, when it was taken off the market.
Now it's back.
Is it back now?
Yeah, now they're auctioning off the Pope's home with a starting bid of $250,000.
It's Pope mania, Sasha. You got to keep up.
I can't keep up. It's back and forth. It's so much here. There's so much Pope business. And quite literally, Chicago businesses, they're cashing in on the Pope. Tell us about the Pope merch that you're seeing, Mac.
Boy. First American Pope, Sasha, you know that comes with a warm welcome of American capitalism, baby. And that's what we're seeing right now. And I got to say, the opportunity window is small and the market is small. It's
get
Catholics
in there fast.
From Chicago, and now it's Catholic White Sox fans from Chicago, I imagine, are the core audience for people buying these shirts. So there are t-shirts companies that are selling Chicago Pope shirts with the White Sox logo on top of it.
Wow.
There were early reports that the Pope was a Cubs fan, as many knew, that were batted down by his brother. But these t-shirt companies are so fast to the punch that one of them put out Chicago Cubs shirts that said on the top of them, God's team, in the colors of the Chicago Cubs.
Wow.
So, everyone is, you have to capitalize on the moment online these days, Sasha. People want to wear what everyone's talking about, and these companies, I think, locally have been making a living off that.
We need a disclosure here, including our own company, which I think got bobbleheads out before.
I was just about to say that.
I'm sorry,
I'm so glad
Sasha.
You're here with me, Angela.
Sorry, Mac, but you're looking at the capitalists right around this room.
Yes.
Maybe not here.
Because our Sun Times, da Pope, cover.
Oh, really?
Oh, we got merch. What do we got? We got mugs. We got shirts.
A shout out to political editor Tony Arnold, who came up with that headline.
That's right.
And if you call
kill
him
me
now.
For saying that.
Call now, 866. I'm kidding. No, but we've got merch too. We're jumping in. But speaking of people, capitalizing off the moment for better or worse, the Pope's here, doing his thing, calling for peace and unity. His older brother, on the other hand, seems to hold very different views. What are social media posts telling us about 73-year-old Louis Prevost?
Bad stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get into the what that he wrote.
He's used some profanities online when talking about Nancy Pelosi, when talking about parents of transgender children. He calls himself a MAGA type.
I was going to say that if you wanted to find out those things, you could go and find the reporting that's been done on that. And I applaud every reporter who has to go and dig up stuff about people. We're trying to understand the background of an individual as monumental and famous as the Pope.
Yeah.
So, of course, we're going to dig into their history, where they came from, who their family members are. But I've got to say, please do not hold me accountable to anything that my siblings or my mother. I mean, ask yourselves out there, Sasha.
But that's what happens when you rise to the top.
But is it your fault that you have a crazy cousin?
No.
Who says all kinds of ridiculous things. I am not going to diss on the reporting that had to get done. I just hope that nobody's going to hold me accountable to my own family members.
Yes.
Or I pray for my family members not to be held accountable to everything I just said.
Well, people have to rely on that reporting, because as of Tuesday, those social media posts I mentioned were no longer publicly viewable. But to your point, Angela, why are we covering what the Pope's brother has said? I mean, is this something that the media should be paying attention to, Mac, Alex?
I mean, no. I think the politics of the Pope are absolutely fascinating. I don't think, really what his brother has said online on into the Facebook ether really matters much to me. But I do think it's interesting that the selection of this Pope is a direct rebuke, to use a word that might be more appropriate for radio than others, to the MAGA movement and to Trump. I mean, this is a Pope from Chicago, the South Suburbs of Chicago, from a place Trump has said nothing good has really ever come out of ever. And this is a Pope who's very publicly online and seems to be carrying on this tradition of really being a voice for immigrants, for people looking for better opportunities than the places they're from who are coming to the U.S. He's tweeted about that, too. I know people were scrounging through his Twitter, which I think was important. So, this is really, I think, in a way, a shot at the way that the American public is moving, and an appeal to the American conscious again. And I think that's what I find most interesting about the selection of Robert Prevost.
The difference of opinions here between the Pope and his brother, it's something that a lot of us can relate to in our families. I think that's the point Angela was trying to make. Almost everyone has that weird uncle. It's fine. But here it is really striking. You got Pope Leo online calling for an end to the fighting in Gaza during his first Sunday address, and his older brother tweeting, quote, "I'd have flattened Gaza and turned it into a parking lot." So wildly, wildly differing opinions, which, by the way, Louis Prevost is doubling down on and also saying, maybe I can tone it down, because now he's heard the media backlash, and so he's saying, I can tone it down, but he's like, but I am who I am.
Let me just throw out there, despite my earlier, like, we are looking to see what is going to influence the Pope. How is the Pope going to influence our existence? And we, when you can't sit down with the Pope at every minute and ask him 1,000 questions, we, of course, are going to look through his history. His mother, who was apparently a saint, you know, his relatives, his friends who knew him from childhood. So we're yearning to understand what this person's going to be influenced by, what has already influenced him. And so that's relevant. I'm just arguing that, like, there's a point by which we cut that off and we wait to see what this Pope will do.
Wait and see. All right. Just about a minute or two here, Mac. I'm looking at you for a couple of things. Temperatures in the 90s yesterday. Yay. We broke a 64-year record for May 15th. But if you went over to enjoy the day at the Humboldt Park Lagoon, you probably were disappointed. Something was missing.
So I love the Humboldt Park Lagoon because of the swan boats. It's something I do at least once every summer. But the provider of the swan boats, they're out. And they're out right before the season starts,
like,
to get
bye.
Out there. They said that they have really struggled with sales ever since the pandemic, that they can't keep the operation afloat, no pun intended. But I'm a little bit surprised that the city, you know, hasn't found another provider, because this is a pretty big draw from what I saw. I always see people out there on the swan boats.
Yeah.
So I'm disappointed, and I would like to say, for the record, I did go on the swan boats out last summer, and I swear I saw a tail of a little alligator popping out of the water.
That, Mac.
So if any reporters want to go check that out again.
And that's the perfect place to end this, gang. Thank you. My thanks for you being here for the weekly news recap. WBEZ's Angela Rosa O'Toole, Alex Nitkin of the Illinois Answers Project, and Mac Lederman. First time from the Block Club Chicago.
Hope I did well, Sasha.
Great
Thank
job,
you.
My friend. Have a great weekend. This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Ari Mejia. Every Friday, Reset brings you the news you need to know in under an hour. So make sure you're subscribed so that you don't miss out. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a good weekend. Thanks for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.